So first of all, I do want to, Potrim Bachsani, I want to thank the Religious Zionists of Chicago and Mizrahi for putting this together. I don't think it's taken for granted that Kimitzion Te Torah is becoming more of a reality. And I particularly want to thank Rabbi Eisenberg and Dr. Laxer, who I would second what Rabbi Blau said earlier. The email that I got last week from Rabbi Eisenberg was quite astounding. It even included a weather report. It was really amazing. My wife had no work left to do. It was so thank you for having me. We are entering a challenging week. It's also an exciting week. And if there is, I remember I did shlichut. I spent 3 years as an adult. I grew up in America. Maybe a little background would be in order. I grew up in New York. I went to Israel when I was 18. I was really a product of the American dream. My great-great-grandfather made Yerida from Lithuania to America. I'm a fourth generation born, and Baruch Hashem, a last generation born, Bezrat Hashem, American. My great-grandfather was born in Connecticut. My grandfather was born in Connecticut. My father was born in Connecticut. And I was born in New York. And I was all set. I had gotten into my dream school, Columbia. I was going to go to Israel to learn for a year after, 4 years of Masifta High School. I was going to come back and do pre-law and law. Came to Israel and just couldn't leave. I went to study in Gush. I stayed Shana Bet. I have a vivid memory of calling up my parents and saying to them, I have news for you. I've decided I'm staying Shana Bet. And at the end of Shana Bet, I'm going to the army. And there was this very long pause on the other end of the line, and to their great credit, that's all it was. And over the years, if you could pick a week where one most feels the difference between being in Chutz Laretz, and in my particular case, being in America, and being in Israel, it would be this coming week. And I especially appreciated this. I'm a personal believer that people who grew up in America and go to Israel, especially when they go young, teacher's degrees, smicha, etc., I think we have a debt of gratitude that we owe to America and to the American Jewish community. So we came back for 3 years to do shlichut. It was a valuable experience. This week was the most difficult week every year that I had in America in terms of what happens in the community, in terms of what happens in school. Yom HaAtzmaut and Yom HaZikaron, in most cases, I actually think from what I'm hearing, Chicago is a little better. Is basically a couple of hours in the evening. At best, the shul organizes a party. I've spoken to many rabbis on this topic. They can't do two different days because who'll come? So they kind of combine it. Yom HaZikaron is an hour at the end of the day. Yom HaAtzmaut is an hour at the beginning of the day. And that's more or less what it is. And then the kids celebrate in school. In Israel, the entire country stops. And if anybody gets motivated by this morning and decides to get on a plane today or tomorrow, I invite you to join us this Tuesday. We'll have an Em Shakula, the mother of a boy, Daniel, who fell, speaking to the boys. Wednesday morning, instead of doing a shiur in the Beit Midrash, we'll go to Har Herzl, and we'll stand with 60,000 in Israel's National Military Cemetery. It's such a powerful day. And then the country explodes at night. The day is a festival on Thursday. There are all sorts of minhagim, minhag hamangal, the barbecue. It doesn't matter what stripe you are. And of late, to their credit, the more Orthodox community, whatever that means, whatever label you give it, Chardal, Haredi, etc., also is out. It's one of the few days of the year where really people come together and put aside their differences. It's a magnificent day, to whatever degree. And so it begs the question, there is an assumption that's being made here this morning, which is that we have a state of Israel, and of course, that's where we should be, that's what we should support. But it raises an interesting question. And I'll share with you a difficult story, because for me it highlights the question. I decided to go to the Army, got invited to commander's course, officer's course, I ended up being in the Army for a good number of years. And at a certain point I was in Lebanon, and the first time that I was in Lebanon, I don't know, whatever it was, 6 months, we were in a very difficult period of time. I was in a mutzav called Mutzav Geffen, which is a position sort of, at the time it was along the border with Syrian troops. Every week something else was going on. I have an older brother who also was in the army. He was in Sidon in what became known as Tzira Mavet, death row, because every week another Tzanchan was being killed. And on the occasions I managed to get out, he was in. When he was out, I was in. Every month and a half or so, we would finally get to see each other, and we would just compare horror stories. And I remember one particular time, we had a new Samach Mempe. We had a new deputy company commander, and the event, because of the nature of the story, I'm not going to share his name. And the old deputy company commander had rotated out to be promoted to a different position. And I didn't really know him. Now, because we were in a difficult state of affairs, and there's always a limited number of officers, pretty much everything that happens in a mutsav in Lebanon in a position has to be accompanied by an officer. Every ambush, every patrol, everything. So every time he managed to get back to the mutsav, to the position, I was out. And when I was back, he was out. And if he had a downtime, and then one of us would go on break, and so on and so forth. So I just didn't know him. And he'd been part of the company, and you have to understand, you have five officers in a company. You have a company commander, a deputy company commander, and three platoon commanders. It's ridiculous that you don't know your deputy company commander. You become very close. But because of the nature of affairs, and when he joined the unit, I really didn't know him. So I guess he realized this and decided that, you know, this is a problem, and he wanted to do something about it. So one morning, it was my turn. Every morning, we would do inspection on the tanks. We didn't always take them on patrols for various reasons, but we would do inspection. And you had to do what's called tipul lifnei tenua. You know, you service the tanks so that they would be ready for the day, whatever the missions might bring. And that was an involved process. And there were certain things that the officer had to do. Right? You had to check the gun sights and make sure that it was working. You had to check thermal imagery. You had to oversee the crews. And you only need one officer. It usually took about an hour, and you only need one officer to do this. And you would go up and down the tank and make sure everybody was, you know, topping off the gas and topping off the oil and whatever else needed to be done. And this was an involved process. You know, you would come back from a mission, you know, sort of usually 4 a.m. after an ambush or whatever it was, and you had like 30 minutes to kind of grab a cup of coffee, and then you would go and start over again, start to pull from the tow, and you were exhausted. And this particular morning, I get out there, and this deputy company commander is on one of the tanks. And I realized he was doing me a solid because all of a sudden now, you know, he decided to help out, which he didn't have to do. Instead of one officer doing it, it was two officers doing it. And that would mean instead of an hour, I'd spend half an hour. That was great. Right? And he was doing it so he could. So we both finished. And then we were walking back to the mess tent. Right? Now, the tanks aren't parked next to the dining room, obviously. So you've got like, I don't know, a kilometer walk, whatever, a 10-minute walk back to the mess tent. And I finally got to start talking to him. Now, I don't know if this was because of our situation or whether he was really funny, but for some reason, maybe it was our exhaustion, he was just hysterical. He was killing me, and we couldn't stop laughing. And he was just very funny. And I remember sort of getting this feeling, this is going to work. Like, this is a solid guy. He helped me out, and now he's walking me back, whatever. And at one point, he's, you know, telling a joke, and then he kind of throws himself down on the ground as part of the joke, right? But, you know, it's not so funny. Like, you're in Lebanon, you know, in the middle of whatever. And, you know, I want to get to the mess tent. I've been up all night, and I'm finally going to get a few hours before my next mission. And I want to get to breakfast. Right? So I'm like, Nuyala. And I give him a kick. Nuyala. I upset her. Okay, funny. Only he's not moving. And I kick him again. It takes me about 30 seconds to realize why he's not moving. He's got a little hole in the side of his head. Now, we were walking, and we were obviously under sniper fire. Later, I would find out that there was a fellow in the minaret of a mosque 200 yards away. It was an unbelievable shot. They found 11 shell casings. He had been firing the whole time we were walking. But of course, you know, when he saw our, you know, epaulettes, we didn't hear anything because the noise of the tank was so loud, right? In real life, you always know that you're under sniper fire. First of all, there's great music. And second of all, you can, right, in the movies, right, you can see the scope. But in real life, you know, you don't know you're under sniper. It's a surreal thing and you can't figure it out. And you suddenly realize he's been hit by a sniper. And I'm standing there in total shock. I'd never been under sniper fire before. And all of a sudden I realize, well, wait a second. If he just got hit, then whoever hit him is probably aiming at me now. Right? And I'm looking at where they were, and I'm looking around, right? And all of a sudden I realize, oh, so I hit the dirt. And now I've got this dilemma. Now, I didn't know him. This wasn't one of those stories where I was broken and it was tragic. I didn't know him. He was a funny guy. And now he's lying down. And over the course of that period of time, a lot of these things happened. And now I have this huge dilemma because I'm smack in the middle of this field. I'm equidistant from the tanks and the guys who are working on the tanks and the mess tent and the radio room. So should I run to the radio room? And there's a way to run if you think there's a sniper. You run 3 seconds, you hit the guy, whatever you're going to do. Should I run and hit the radio room and then I can get on the radio and tell everybody like there's a sniper, everybody should get in the tanks, don't walk through the field. But then what if somebody starts walking? Or should I run back to the tanks and tell everybody to get in the hatches and use one of the tank radios, but what if somebody comes out from the radio room? So I lie there for another 30 seconds trying to figure out what to do, And I finally decided to run through the radio rooms. I run through the radio room and let them know, thank God nobody walked through the field. All the tank crews got inside. They sent out some patrols. I didn't have a chance to even process this because all of a sudden I had to now take over a patrol. Right? Now, you don't stop what you're doing because someone got hit. You've got roads to open, dangers involved, etc. So within 20 minutes, 30 minutes, I was out on a patrol. And as I said, I didn't really know him. You know, later that day or the next morning, you know, somebody talked to me and they wanted to understand it, whatever. There was one thing, though, that I was struggling with. And that was, I obviously didn't go to the funeral. We were up in Lebanon. We were on duty. There's no one to take my place. We were now shorthanded. We had one less officer. So that meant it really got crazy. We had to change the shifts instead of 6 hours off, 4 hours off. Eventually, I got a message that the family wanted to meet me. I was the last one who was with him, and they eventually found this out. I did not want to meet them in the worst way, because I knew what they were going to ask me. They were going to ask me, what were his last words? And I remember exactly what his last words were. He was a secular guy in the middle of a joke. I can't repeat them here. I did not want to tell this family what their son's last word was. So eventually, the battalion said, you have to go. And I went for the shloshim, and I sat with them for a while. And like I said, I had no relationship to this soldier. And I had this dilemma. Should I make something up? And I don't know if I'm right. One day, you know, at Me'av Esrim, I'll find out. But I made something up. I made up this whole conversation and this phenomenal line that he said. And he was serving Am Yisrael and whatever it was. And I think it gave them a lot of nechama. And that was the end of the story. And that's why, by the way, I didn't keep in touch with them. Because I was afraid if I would stay in touch with them, they would somehow figure out that that was not true. But there's a sequel to this story, because that was one of the most intense months I had in the Army. Every day something else was going on. Now there's something in the Army known as a Yoman Yeruim. Yoman Yeruim is it's a diary that every unit has to keep of every event that happens. It gets pushed up to brigade headquarters and eventually to division headquarters. And if a unit is experiencing sort of a higher level of significant difficult events, then eventually they pull them off the line. And that's what happened to us. After that month, they pulled us off the line, and we were given a week, 5 days, in Beit Goldman's, which is this amazing place. One day I'm going to meet the Goldman's family. It's this sort of motel where they run seminars for soldiers who are in battle, who have difficult times. The Israeli army is phenomenal at dealing with these issues, at least from my experience. And so all of a sudden, we find ourselves in this three-star hotel. Now, three-star motel, you might not stay, but it was unbelievable. There were carpets in the rooms. There were four of us in a room, and we each had our own shower and bathroom and a toilet you could sit on. It was really unbelievable, right? And they had food, and the food was cooked. It wasn't battle. It was incredible. Every morning we had to go for a run, but with no gear on. We just got into a pair of shorts and ran, so that was also amazing. And every night they gave us off. We weren't allowed to go home, which wouldn't have been a difference for me, because they wanted the guys to bond and chill. We would go to movies and some of the things I couldn't do, and so on and so forth. And during the day, we would have meetings with social workers and kabanas, a ketzin b'riyut nefesh, an army psychologist, psychiatrist, and go through these events. And eventually, we get to this event. Now, just to give you an understanding of what I was nervous about, anybody see the movie Saving Private Ryan? Okay, so my wife said to me, because she knew this story a little bit, my wife said to me, when that came out, she said, you got to see this movie. She had seen a piece of it, I don't know exactly what it was, so we went to see this movie, a powerful movie about World War II and depicts things that are very difficult. It actually gave me personally an appreciation for how lucky I was to be in the Israeli army. But there's a scene in the movie where this captain who's been going through all these difficult times, his hand is shaking. Do you remember the scene? And he didn't want his men to see that his hand is shaking. Well, this is true. This actually happens, right? And ever since that event and a couple of other events, I started noticing that one of my hands was shaking. And I didn't know what it was. But I didn't want my men to see that my hand is shaking because they think like something's wrong, and I didn't want anybody to pull me off the line or anything, you know. So I kind of like just, you know, didn't notice it. I figured, oh, whatever it is, it'll go away. I'll deal with it later, whatever it was. And apparently this is a phenomenon that happens. It's a post-traumatic stress. I don't know, whatever it is. So this morning we're sitting there and we're going through this event. And this woman who's a social worker is going through the event, and she gets to this point in this story, which is really focused on me. And you got to realize, we're sitting the whole, my whole machlaka, you know, all 11, 12, you know, whatever, 30 soldiers who were sitting with the platoon, right? And we're going through the events, and we're supposed to share, and everybody's supposed to, but you know, we're Israelis, we're, you know, So they get to this, you know, and they start to, you know, ask me to describe the event, and, you know, I'm in front of my men, you know. Oh, walking through the field, and, you know, he got shot. So she looks at me, she goes, well, you know, how did you feel about it? And I said, what an Israeli says when he realizes we're going to talk about it, he says, I said, said though, you know, it's okay, you know, whatever. They said, she says, that's it? I said, so she says, you know, did you struggle with it? Said that, you know, it's okay, you know. And this goes back and forth. And she leans forward and she says, did you struggle with this at all? Now, the last thing I'm going to do is open up and say, yes, I struggled and it was difficult and I'm thinking about it. My men are sitting there, you know, I'll never hear the end of it. So I said, said them, you know, right? Said them. So finally she leans forward and she says, so then why are you sitting on your hand? And there's this pause. And all the guys are looking at my hand and I realize this is real. And that's just like one little microcosm of what Israelis go through. And how many different experiences and how many different events. You know, I had a student. His name was Dvir Mochaim. I remember when I met him, because I was towards the end, or still learning in Smicha, and I got this opportunity to be a madrich, to be a dorm counselor in Neve Shmuel High School. And I was offered the job by Rav Riskin, and he said, you know, this is going to be your job, whatever it is, but you have to meet the principal. And it was sort of a foregone conclusion. They were short madrichim, but, you know, the principal has to okay it. So I was going to meet the principal. I kind of thought I had the job. And I'm sitting outside the principal's office, and there's a boy sitting there. And he looks like the boy called to the principal's office. So I really connected to that, because that was me quite often when I was in school. And so I started talking with him, and he was a great kid. You know, we start talking, and I said, you know, are you in trouble? He goes, eh, whatever, again, right? So we're having this conversation. And after about 10 minutes, you know, they come outside, and they see me, and they call me and sit with the principal. And I'm sitting with him, and he's talking to me, and, you know, interviewing me, and then says, okay, well, we'd love for you to start, and, you know, you'll start at the end of the summer, etc. And I said, do you know which grade I'll be with? So he kind of looks up surprised, you know, interviewees don't really care which grade they get, so he says, no, I'm not really sure why. I said, well, I just met a boy, you know, Dvir Morchaim, and we kind of hit it off, so I would love to have the grade he's in. So he looks at me with a smile, he goes, well, I'm not so sure he'll be here when you get here. Now, I don't know what possessed me to say this. I guess, you know, you're trying to impress the new boss. But I said, well, if he is here, I'll take him on as a project. I think he's a great kid. Right? And he looks up, you know, kind of arches his eyebrows, says, okay, duly noted, fine, and I go. And then I'm walking away thinking, oh, that was a dumb thing to do, but all right. And I forgot about it. 2 months later, I'm starting as a madrich, and we're going through the roster, and they've split us up into which grade. And, you know, sort of one evening I'm sitting with the head of the dorms and whatever, we're going through the students to talk about who the students are. And he gets to this name, Dvir Morchaim, and he looks up, he says, and I understand you've agreed to take him on as a special project. I said, oh. So because of that, we became very close. And as it turned out, he was a superstar. And as soon as sort of people started to notice this and he was given responsibility, he transformed, everything transformed for him. He had a phenomenal 11th grade, phenomenal 12th grade. He ended up going to Eli, to Mechinat Eli, studying in Eli, and then drafting into the Tzanchanim. And about a year and a half after that, I was sitting in our living room. I was still in the Kollel on Olam Shvut. It was my last year in the Kollel. This is the worst way to hear this. And I'm watching the news. And there was a terrible story in Lebanon. There was a siur that was coming back. They had been in an all-night ambush in Ma'arav, which means they're looking for, you know, whatever, terrorists. And it was a very foggy night. And the officer apparently had messed up. At night, when you walk in night distances. Right? When you walk in the day, Rivcheyom, day distances are much wider to kind of protect the unit, that if somebody shoots at you, they won't hit everybody. But at night, for all sorts of reasons, you walk a lot closer together. And he hadn't noticed, because they were at the end of the mission, they were a couple of kilometers from the border, nothing had happened, you know, they could see the lights already of whatever it was, Kiryat Shmona. And he was heading towards the border, and he had let the distances develop. And he hadn't noticed, because he knew generally the direction they were heading, in the fog that he was starting to curve because of the nature of the terrain. And they eventually curved back. And the end of the line, which had opened up, curved the same way. And all of a sudden, they see silhouettes of, you know, guys in the darkness, in the fog. And in that particular area, at that particular time, if you saw someone with a gun walking in the distance, you knew there were no other Israeli troops in the area that was set up that way. You hit the ground and you opened up. And what's called a dutz dadi, opened up, and Dvir was killed. And I remember standing at the kever, I visit him from time to time in Har Herzl, on a mountain in Har Herzl, and it raises a question. Because, you know, we talk about the challenges, but sometimes you have to understand how personal the price is. We pay a very difficult price for having the State of Israel. And the question is it worth it? Is it worth it? You know, here we are, we're Tzioni, and we should all come home to Israel. But you know what? I have a son in Tzanchanim, right? Rav Blau has sons who are growing up in Israel. That's a very difficult decision. I've never, ever had difficulty. You know, sort of when a mother tells me that she doesn't want her son going to the army, I get that. And I don't get involved in those discussions. That's between boys and their parents. But it's a difficult price. Is it worth it? And it raises the question, do we really need this? Why do we need a Jewish state? Now, if you ask, okay, the average 16-year-old, why do we need a Jewish state? They usually, eventually, within 30 seconds, come up with a popular answer, especially if they're not living in sort of the Torah world. Why do we need a Jewish state? So that, what do you think? We'll never have another Holocaust, right? We learned 70, 80 years ago what happens when you don't have a Jewish state. We need to have a place to guarantee that we never have another Holocaust. What's the problem with that approach? If you really are convinced that there's not going to be another Holocaust, then you don't need a Jewish state. Now, we may have our questions today with what's going on in America, but I promise you, if you ask the average, much less affiliated Jew who's living, whether it's in San Diego, even this week, they would never imagine there's going to be another Holocaust. They don't think that we need to worry about that in America, and I've heard all the debates. America's a melting pot society, it could never happen here, and so on and so forth. So, if the only reason we have a Jewish state is because we want to be prepared for another Holocaust, then if there's never going to be another Holocaust, we don't need a Jewish state. Now, by the way, there were people, for example, Yossi Beilin, who was one of the architects of Oslo. Now, you could debate whether back in 1993 it was legitimate, we took enough risks for war, maybe it was time to take a risk for peace. I'm not the one who's going to stand in judgment of people who took that line, but I think today everybody recognizes that that was a mistake, with hindsight, which is easier. But if you ask Yossi Beilin, he would say, you don't need a Jewish state. Israel should be a state like every other state. And you should have Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis and Swedish Israelis. Okay? If you ask others, I actually had the privilege of meeting Yitzhak Rabin a number of times. I believe Yitzhak Rabin really felt that we need a Jewish state. I just don't think he knew why. I had an opportunity to see a discussion that's longer than we have time for. I don't think he had any idea why we need a Jewish state. And the problem is that when the body bags start coming home, then that question comes out of the bag. And people start asking, why do we need this? And so the best way to make sure that we don't ask that question, for which we have no answer, is that we got to solve this problem. We got to have peace. We got to make two states. Whatever you think the solution is. Is that all there is to it? Or is there something deeper going on? So I want to share with you two ideas. Two brief ideas, which maybe respond to this issue to give us some food for thought. The first is... it's an interesting concept. You can find it in many areas, but we'll use the story of Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was arguably the first Zionist. Right? Hashem comes to him, what was probably southern Iraq, Mesopotamia, and says, Lech Lecha. He says, go. Yes. Right? Pardon? Oh. He says, Lech Lecha, Elarat Sherecha, right? Elarat Sheromar Elecha, the land that I'm going to show you, the land. That's right. Okay, Baruch Hashem, see? You're right. We have a knowledgeable audience. Right? Okay? So there's an interesting question, right? He's in the middle of nowhere. By the way, he's a nobody. He's 75 years old. He has no children. And from the context of the fact that Hashem says, right, Avarecha, I will increase your wealth, you'll become wealthy. That's one of the things Hashem promises him. It must be that he's not exactly wealthy. We don't know what he did, except for break idols in the Medrash. He's a schnook. He's got no kids. He's a nebuch, right? And one could take that position. And Hashem comes along and says to him, right, I want you to go. I'm not telling you what, just go. Now, there's an interesting Rashi on that pasuk, right? Lech lecha. So Rashi says, letovatcha ulanatcha. I don't want you to go for me. I want you to go for you. This is going to be good for you. And in fact, if you look at the pasukim, Rav Avigdor Nebenzahl has a magnificent sicha on this in his sichot on the parsha. And he suggests that there are three basic promises. Like the Torah tells us, there are three promises, right? I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to make you famous. I'm going to make you wealthy, and I'm going to give you progeny. Right now you have none of that, right? It's Chalagoy Gadol, Avavarechecha, right? And by the way, the continuation of that parsha, when Avraham proceeds to follow Hashem's words and gets to Eretz Yisrael for a short period of time, is the fulfillment of those dreams. He becomes well known, he goes down to Mitzrayim and becomes wealthy, he's promised a son Yishmael, in the following parsha he's promised a son Yitzchak, and b'met, his life changes. So of course, the obvious question is, well, if God came to you, I mean, I'm not going to pass judgment. I don't personally believe that we should judge individuals. I do think we have a right to take a step back and wonder whether the klal, whether the larger social fabric or rubric of the Jewish people is getting the message that we need to get. I do think that there are a lot of reasons that I would understand that a person would stay in Chutz Laaretz. You know, parents are ill, people are suffering from their own illnesses, maybe there are parnasa issues, right? You know, can you make a livelihood? Those are all valid questions, and I don't deign to judge the individual. You know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, all stayed in America. It's not for me to say that they're wrong, you know, chas v'shalom. That being said, when you take a step back and you look at the larger picture of the entire sort of Jewish community overseas, which is a little over half of the Jewish population in the world, you would be legitimate in suggesting maybe we need to rethink this. We should be coming home. But if God came to you living in Chicago and you absolutely knew Hashem was talking to you and he said, if you go to Chicago, I'm going to make you wealthy. You know? God came to you in the form of Bill Gates and said to you, I have a friend, John Medved, and if you go now to Israel, he's going to set you up with a company and you'll earn $5 million a year. And not only that, you're 60 years old, don't worry. All your kids are going to be married within the year and you're going to have 10 grandchildren in 2 years. You'd book flights tonight. So what's the big deal that Avram does this? Not to mention the fact that if you're doing it for reward, then it's not really real. I mean, right? Doesn't the Mishnah tell us, don't serve the master in order to gain reward. We should be doing this not because of what we'll get, because of who we are. You know, my daughter had a fascinating insight. We spent 3 years in Florida. The third year, she was in eighth grade, and we decided that was the limit. I didn't want my kids starting high school in America for a variety of reasons. So we were going back. But she made some very close friends, and she stayed in touch with them thanks to social media. And when she was in 12th grade, or Shministit, so her friends that she was still close with, two or three of them, started sending her, you know, messages. I'm coming to Israel next year, but I'm thinking, where do you think I should go? Do you know anything about this place and that place? Midrash at Lindenbaum, Harova, whatever. Where should I go? I immediately said, well, obviously, Rav Blau also teaches Midrash at Lindenbaum. That's where you should go. But putting aside that, right? So, and they kept asking me, you know, will I get more out of this place? Will I get more out of that place? And one day we're sitting at the Shabbos table, and my daughter turns to me and says, you know, I just figured out the difference between growing up in America and growing up in Israel. All my friends in Israel, right? All my friends in America are trying to figure out where we're going to get the most. And all my friends in Israel are trying to figure out where we're going to give the most. Do I go to Shirut Lumi? Do I go to the army? Right? Avraham Avinu is told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you need to come to Israel. Because when you get to Israel, you will gain the tools that you need. But the tools that you gain are not to have those tools. The tools you gain because that's how you become who you meant to be. Lech lecha, you need to go and become you. You need to become the Avram you're meant to be. And you cannot become the Avram that you're meant to be in Mesopotamia. Go to Israel, become who you're meant to be, and by becoming who you're meant to be, you'll change the world. And this is true. The Jewish people in exile were missing so much. It is remarkable what we succeeded in doing and how we succeeded in surviving. But we were survivors. You know, there was a whole discussion this year around Yad Vashem as to whether we should call those who lived through the Shoah survivors, right? Or those who were saved. A person who's saved is saved for something. Whereas a person who survived just got through it. We didn't just, in exile, you survive, right? As a collective, I'm not talking about as an individual. In Israel, it's much bigger than that, right? The nation gets to Israel. Look, you know, we say, Asher b'char banu mikol amim. And I have a vivid memory of saying Kiddush in some very difficult situations in the army and later. And I remember one particular Kiddush thinking about those words. What does that mean? Asher b'char banu mikol ha'amim. And if you go to college campuses, you know, we spend a fair amount of time visiting our alumni, or Blau will be at the University of Chicago tonight, I think, right? Right? Because yeshiva should never be a one-year program. It's at least a five-year program. Because if you don't stay in touch with them and continue to grow with them while they're in college, then I'm not sure what you've accomplished. But one of the questions, right, that students struggle with, right, is this question. Are we somehow, if we're the chosen people, are we better than everybody else? To be chosen does not mean you're better. It just means you're different. Right? If we decide to have a kumzitz, right? Sfirat Ta'omer, right? So we wouldn't do a kumzitz with a guitar. You can tell I keep Sfirat Ta'omer. My wife calls this Cuban Terrorist Month. It doesn't really work for me. But if I was going to do a kumzitz, I'd ask my son if he wants to join me. Because he loves to play guitar. Right? And he would feel chosen to join me and to play guitar together. I wouldn't ask my daughter, because for my daughter, a guitar is something you can throw in a fire and make a kumzitz in a different way, right? That doesn't mean that my son is better. It just means he's different. So I'm not sure that the Torah wants us to feel that we're better than the other nations of the world. You think about a person like Raoul Wallenberg, you feel better than such a person, right? To be chosen means you're chosen for something. And the question becomes, what are we chosen for? What's our mission? The Jewish people have a mission. And that mission cannot be accomplished in its entirety anywhere else but in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Blau alluded to the fact, right? Dr. Hachhauser also alluded to the fact that there's something different. We're part of this experiment which is unique in the annals of human history. Right? Just as an example, an ancient people have revitalized an ancient language that's now spoken as a modern vernacular. And hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are coming home to the place they call home because it was the home of their ancestors thousands of years ago. That just doesn't happen. But what's the goal of that? The goal of that is to create a model society. Right? Can we become a society that the world looks at and says, that's how it should be? Can we be an Or LaGoyim? I'll give you an example. In 1982, some of us will remember exactly where we were and what we were doing when that happened. But in 1982, 20,000 Israeli troops on an early Sunday morning crossed the border into Lebanon. That was the beginning of the Lebanon War. I know they call it the first Lebanon War, the second, it's really one war. That was the beginning, right? 20,000 troops crossed into Lebanon, invaded a foreign country. And for the better part of 20 years, until Barak pulled them back in 2000, which is its own discussion, they estimate that over 250,000 troops, including yours truly, spent significant time in Lebanon. During all that period of time, there was not one reported case of rape. There was no instance where an Israeli soldier was accused of raping a Lebanese Arab, a Palestinian, or anything else in between. Not reported by the army, not reported by the press, not reported by the Red Cross, not reported by the Red Crescent Society, nobody. I challenge any army in the world to live up to that statistic. In that statistic, the Israeli army is a Jewish army. Now, I don't think the Israeli army is perfect by a long shot. There are things we will always need to work on. But that's what it means to be an Or LaGoyim. You cannot create that kind of model if you're living in Brooklyn or Teaneck or Chicago. So on one level, we have a mission. And by the way, the accomplishment of that mission is not just for us. It's because the world needs us to accomplish that mission. So that one day we can arrive at Bayamahu Yashem Echadush Moichan. So that's one idea. I will share with you very quickly one more idea, and we'll call it a close. And the best example I could think of on this topic, you know, we take Oraita to Poland every year. It's not accidental that Yad Vashem and Yom Ha'atzmaut and Yom Zikaron are all in the same 7 days. And Rav Blau and I sort of alternate. He was there this year, I'll be there next year. And we have an amazing tour guide. He's a very special person, Yitzhak Rubinstein. And he shared, the year that I was there, he shared the following story. He loaded us up into a cattle car at the train station outside of Lodz. He pushed us all in the back. There must have been about 30 of us. He wanted us to feel what it was like to stand there. And he began to describe the conditions of standing in a cattle car. We don't appreciate this, right?
Oh, yes, I do.
Okay.
Between my mother and father, 67 people died in Holocaust.
67, wow.
H. Kodesh was my uncle.
The H. Kodesh was your uncle?
My grandmother's brother.
Oh, you are so staying afterwards for a discussion. Okay. Wow. Okay. It was worth coming just to hear that. Okay. So if you were in Saloniki, as an example. There were 80,000 Jews in Saloniki before the Nazis invaded Saloniki. Most of them were herded onto cattle cars and ended up being murdered in Auschwitz. The train journey for the Jews of Saloniki was almost 10 days. They pushed 120 human beings into these cattle cars. It meant you were standing one against the other like this. There was no room to sit. There was no room to lie down. Nothing. If you were a child, how long could you be held when all the adults had no food, they had no water? Eventually you were on the ground. What happens to 120 people with one little bucket in the middle for 10 days? Right? The floor. Think about what the floor must have been like for a child sitting there. On the third day, they would pull up by a siding and they would throw out some of the bodies. They estimate that 1 in 5 actually reached Auschwitz alive. We don't appreciate this. So they're in a cattle car, a group of Jews, coming from the Warsaw ghetto, headed to Treblinka. And one of them is a fellow named Rabbi Yaakov David Fastak. He was the menagin, the one who wrote nigunim, wrote tunes for the Mezhitzer Rebbe. You know, the Mezhitzers were known for the nigunim. And a nigun comes into his head. This is a true story. And he starts singing this nigun. You know this nigun. And the words that he's singing this tune to are absolutely mind-boggling. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima b'viyat ha-mashiach. One of the 13 principles of the Rambam. I believe totally in the coming of Mashiach, that redemption will come. And though he may tarry, I know that one day he'll come. And I will wait for him every day. He's in the cattle car on the way to Treblinka. They've been in the Warsaw ghetto. He knows where he's headed. And he starts to sing this nigun. Unbelievable. And you can hear the sounds of the train tracks in this nigun, right? Ani ma'amin, ani ma'amin, clickety-clack, clickety-clack. This nigun was, this became the anthem of the Jewish people around the Holocaust. And he starts to sing this, and he realizes this is an amazing nigun. He doesn't want to lose it. So he keeps singing it, and people next to him, what else do you have to do? They start singing with him. And pretty soon, everybody in the car is singing this nigun. And I imagine it must have elevated them. Now, if a carload of Jews are singing a nigun, then the car next to them is going to hear this. And they know that Yaakov David Fastag is somewhere in one of these cars, so I imagine that they figured out what this is, and they start singing it too. So pretty soon, you have a train of Jews on their way to one of the darkest places on earth, and they're singing an imamin. Unbelievable. And eventually, Yaakov David Fastag realizes this nigun can't die. This has to get to the Rebbe of Mezhitz. So he starts asking, I need volunteers. I want 2 volunteers who are willing, will help you to escape from this train so that you can eventually find your way to the Rebbe of Mezhitz and give him this nigun. He was a menagin, so he wrote the notes down on pieces of paper. And nobody wanted to volunteer, given the mentality of Jews, and to get out of a window in a moving train. So then he announces, if 2 of you will volunteer, I promise you, I will give each of you half of my chelek in Olam Haba, half of my portion in the world to come. He was the Shamish of the Rebbe of Mezhitz. And these were Mezhitzer Hasidim, so 2 boys volunteer. How they do that is a story that I'm not fully aware of, but they manage to escape from the car. One of them is killed, one of them survives. He eventually gets to, I believe it was Brooklyn after the war. And Rav Yitzchak Rubinstein, our tour guide, heard this story from a person who was there when this nigun was shared with the Rebbe of Mezhitz. And the question I walk away with that from that is, how do you find that faith on a journey like that? How have we gotten to this point to even consider, to contemplate this mission after the 2,000 years we've been through? So I'll give you a very quick response. Think about the beginning of Sefer Yoshua. Yoshua is about to enter Eretz Yisrael. They've just had 30 days of mourning. Moshe passed away. When the 30 days are up, it's time to go. And Hashem comes to Yoshua and says, Kum aleiresh, you're going to inherit the land. And so Yoshua now takes over the mantle of the leadership. Perek Aleph of Yoshua is really all about the transition, that the Jewish people should accept Yoshua as they did Moshe. Now it's Yoshua's turn. What's the first thing Yoshua does as the leader of Jewish people? Anybody know? Right now? First thing, sends 2 spies. Remember this? Could you think of a dumber idea? Spies? Really? You don't remember that? He was one of them. Ridiculous. So he sends 2 spies. So you could debate what the difference is. So what do you do if you're a Jewish spy in the time of Yeshua and you got to spy out the land? He gives them a very clear mandate. Go spy out the land, see what's going on. Where do you go if you're a Jewish spy? You've been learning Torah in the desert for 40 years under Yeshua. Straight to a brothel. Okay. So I know they debate, you know, was it really a brothel from the word zonah? Was she really an innkeeper from the word mazon? Was she a once from the brothel? Now, but put that aside. It's not really a place the boys from Slobodka hung out in. But okay. So these two guys go in there. Now these are the worst spies in history. They're caught within 10 minutes. Right? Vayishma Melech. They're just sitting there. I have this image. These two spies, right? Sounds like a joke. Two spies walk into a bar, right? And they got to order a drink, right? So they say, well, do you have milk? You know, they're not going to, First of all, it's Yein Akum. Second of all, is it Chalav Yisrael? They start having a debate. They're wearing their tzitzis, their kapotes, right? I was in France a number of years ago. And in France, they have a terrible minhag. They walk out of shul, they all take off their kippot because they're scared, right? And my wife said to me before we were there, said, listen, this isn't your battle. I'm not comfortable with you walking around the streets of Paris with a kippah on. And I really struggled with this, but I said, you know, if that's what you want, then fine, we're not. I didn't come here to, right? So she brought me a baseball hat. It said a raita on it. It was kind of funny, but all right. So I put this baseball hat, and I said to her, we're walking out of shul, one by one, they all, and there was this one guy, he had a kapata and a beard, and his two little kids would pay us, but he puts on a baseball hat. I said, come on! They'll never know, right? So these two spies are caught. And you know the story. Rachav takes them up on the roof, and they're, you know, and she says, you have to hide. And then she hides them. They make a deal. They listen to her. 3 days in the mountains. And when they're done, they go straight back across the border and they have to report to Yeshua. Now, I would imagine that that must be a very uncomfortable moment. Because, you know, talk about a failed mission. But listen to what they say. This is a remarkable line. Right? At the end of Sefer Yeshua, what do they say? Vayashuvu shnei anashim vayodu me'ahar. Right? They go back. They come down from the mountain. And they tell him everything that happened. Hashem has given us the land. They're terrified. In other words, we succeeded. Seriously? It's a very strange story. So there's a word in here that alludes to our question about this will end. They say, now this is interesting. If you look in Parshat Maaseh, which describes the journeys of the Jewish people, right? Moshe describes Maasehem and Motsaotehem, and it's repeated. What does it mean? What's a Motsa? A Motsaot, right? You think about the list of places the Jewish people went to in the desert, and the Mefarshim, the commentary suggests these aren't really places. Like, how do you explain where you were? I was by the third sand dune next to the creek bed. It's not really a place. There's nobody living there. There's no. And Rashi goes further, based on the Gemara, these places don't even exist, right? We looked in all the Tanakh, lo matzanu makom, we didn't find a place called Tofa Lavan. There's no such place. So it's really talking about when the Jews complained about the man which was white. We didn't find a place called Dizahav. It's really about the place which was gold, Zahav means gold, the golden calf. In other words, these are not places, these were experiences. What the Meraglim are basically saying is, we went on a mission, but we didn't know where we were going to go and what was going to happen. And this is what found us. What do we say in the morning? One of the brachot we say is Hamichin Mitzadei Gaver. The Gemara in Brachos says that you say this when you step down, you've put your shoes on, and you start to walk. As you start your day, you take a moment to think, you know, I think I know what I'm doing. I'm going to wake up, I'm going to go to an 8 o'clock minyan, I'm going to come here, I'm going to get myself a cup of coffee, and I'm going to listen to a blah give a shir. That's what I think. And then I'm going to find out, what has Hashem planned? Right? You're in a traffic jam, and somebody slams into your car. And what that means is, you thought you were headed somewhere, Hashem wants you somewhere else. Right? It's like, you know, do you have a religious paper here? I don't know, in Israel they have all these religious papers, Hamodia, you know, Haredi, right? All these religious papers, but they're not really religious papers, because if they were really religious papers, they wouldn't say something like, you know, 300 missiles were shot, or 600 missiles were shot. They would say, Hashem decided this morning to allow Hamas to shoot 600 missiles. Hashem decided, Nebuch, that Obama would be reelected, right? If we really understood that, then we would live in a different reality. And that's the second piece of this puzzle. For 2,000 years, we have been on a journey. And the Jewish people never gave up believing that this journey was going to bring us home. And I have to be honest with you, I'm going to leave you with a question. I get why people struggle with making a bracha on Yom Ha'atzmaut. I do. It's a legitimate question. I get the debate. how a person, in the face of events of our modern day, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, who see what happened, who see the Jewish people that were outnumbered 15 to 1. It's absurd that we have a state today. And look at those events and don't see Yad Hashem. I don't understand anything more heretical than that. And that's our challenge. Our challenge is to believe, on the one hand, from a collective, from a whole, that Hashem has brought these events into our lives for a reason, and we need to think about what that means. I think, to be honest, it means more than just writing a check to the Zionist, to Mizrahi, which I think is a good thing to do. I wasn't paid to say that. And I think we have to challenge ourselves. What is our journey? How do we participate in this? What is the mission of the Jewish people? And how do we become a part of that? And we should all have a meaningful Yom HaZikaron and a wonderful Chag HaTzmon. And thank you again to Mizrahi for hosting this event.